In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Hello and good afternoon. I had the pleasure to already have a few conversations with Suki and General Pötzsch, and this actually boosted my trust into what we in Germany and Europe could do against hybrid warfare and what we do in regards of cybersecurity a lot. So I hope you will have the same feeling afterwards. So I'm going to start with a very short question. Speaking of cybersecurity, on a scale from 1 miserable to 10 amazing, where do we stand in Europe in regards of cybersecurity?
I'll give you another number. 202 billion euros last year damaged by cybercrime in Germany alone. So I won't talk about a number between 1 and 10 for our level of cybersecurity.
You're in the minus.
Yeah, I would like to keep being optimistic, not start like today in the morning. It's very dark and a foggy topic we're talking about. But I'd say we're doing good, but 10, I think, is unrealistic.
Thank you, Suki.
It's going to make me be more optimistic, aren't you?
You have to.
Zero. Okay, that's a little bit better.
It's not a negative number, but it's not. Everything changes. And based on the amount of threats, based on the things that have happened last week, Cloudflare, you look at what's going on, zero's not bad. It's not great, but it's not a negative number.
Do you think of any country or region
No.
who has more than zero? No. But then... It was a stupid scale.
I think you have to be realistic. And ultimately, with the changes that are going on in technology, the speed at which they are happening, you can say, oh, yeah, great. You know, today we're a 5. But realistically, I don't think there's anybody that's going to be on the top end of that scale because of the rate of change. So it's always going to be continually moving. I don't know when we're going to be actually in a state of saying we are really good, because bad actors are always looking for a better way to be bad.
And to be honest, even if we reach that state, I'm not sure I would want to talk about that, because I would like to keep that sense of urgency, which has been missing much too long concerning questions of cybersecurity. And now the people are starting to understand, and they are starting to struggle to reach this 1, this 2, this 3. And I really like to see people struggle in this field, because we have so much to do and we have to adapt. I mean, we will be talking about threats, I guess, but threats are evolving while we are sitting here discussing what we know from the last 2 weeks yeah. or days or whatever. And so we can't just lean back and say, hey, as you said, we're 5 today. While I'm saying it, we're going down to 3, 2 yeah. and nil. So let's be realistic. We will always have to struggle each and every minute.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Germany, at least, we had last week big discussions around digital sovereignty. And there were two big data centers announced. And I think new words were found. I think it was industrial AI, cloud, or something like that. Very interesting. But which role, and this is to you, General Pötzsch, which role does cybersecurity play in all of the efforts of digital sovereignty that we are seeing now in Europe, and especially in Germany?
I mean, without security, there is no sovereignty. And actually, it's also the other way around. Without sovereignty, you won't have security. Why is that so? I mean, I can have the most sophisticated tech stack. If it's not secure, it's not really sovereign, what I'm doing there. And the other way around, if I'm very good in security, but not on a sovereign hardware level, for example, I'm not really good in security. Because if we're talking about sovereignty, which, by the way, is already mentioned on the stage, a bit misleading as a word. I would say it's not autarky we're striving for. It's about having a decision, about being able to make a decision and not a binary decision between yes and no, but a real decision. So if we're talking about digital sovereignty, for example, in terms of cloud, it's about having decision between one, two, three vendors. And in the best case, one of those vendors is from our country or from Europe, at least.
And right now, you have limited choice of vendors. And as we were having a conversation, I think many of us have had this conversation about it being there are very few players in the market for you to have digital sovereignty. So it's a matter of, especially for governments, is you don't have the talent to build what you need to build in order to have that sovereignty. So at the very base, you don't have the education to have the talent to build the sovereignty for you internally. So now you have to go externally to a vendor. And of course, we know that the people that are having those tools are not always acting in the best interests of a country. It's more in the best interests of stakeholders.
Could it be that you speak about software? I mean, one of the questions for you is, I mean, when we talk, the one question which comes to mind first was hardware, right? I mean, how to make hardware that is used in data centers, in cars, in everything, to really make them secure and safe. I think this is a big challenge. But the other question is it a risk that we need to take, and this is for you, Suki, is it a risk that we need to take, for example, to use Palantir?
A risk? I think it's a known risk.
Known risk.
Yes.
Known.
Before it was a risk because nobody was sure. But after Cambridge Analytica, after all of this, Palantir, it's a known risk. It's a matter of how much of your security, how much of your data you're willing to give up. And I think now we're in the state of awareness. It's more of whether or not you're aware of what you're giving, but then it's understanding how far that goes. And when you look at digital sovereignty, or even digital IDs in the UK, and despite the accent, I am British American, but in the UK, the government announced a digital ID recently. But then Apple in the US announced a digital ID, which would be rolling out on the App Store for, I think, is identification in a number of, they were trialing it in a number of areas in the airports. So that's the rate of technology. A company has rolled out something that the UK government is wanting to roll out. By the time the UK government gets around to it, it will probably be 2028, the earliest. I think it's earmarked for 2029, but the earliest is 2028. You have Apple already rolling that out and testing it. Mm. So once again, we come to that conundrum where governments cannot act fast enough because they don't have the talent and the skill internally to do that. And of course, they don't have the money to pay people to want to be in government to do that.
Now my optimism kicks in at least a tiny little bit. I mean, I'm absolutely with you talking about awareness. Pessimistically said, being aware that you're terminally ill still leaves you dead, but at least you know what's coming. Yeah. So again, I would love to take two steps back and say software can help. I mean, you can't separate those two. You can't have hardware without software. That's just, I mean, you can, on a theoretical level, you can look at both of them, but in reality, today, what we are striving for is have more hardware agnostic software so that we can have software solutions which are perhaps sovereign, because looking at AI, it's our model, it's our data, it was our training. So each and every step was under our control, and this software can run on different hardware stacks. So that's a step forward. It still leaves me with the problem of being dependent in terms of hardware, but it's a huge step forward in terms of sovereignty if we're talking about AI, for example.
And since you're also leading the innovation part with that very long title, And I mean, there's lots of efforts. We have heard this on many other panels today. Would you, and also you, Suki, Dr. Pitch, would you think there is a chance for, since you could guess, you could say Germany and Europe start slowly and late and not enough money, but isn't there also a chance to leapfrog?
If I may? Go ahead. at least for the military domain, yeah, I think yes. Because if we're, for example, again, if we're talking about AI, I don't need this large language model telling me in the morning how to make my breakfast pancakes and in the evening how to do an anti-terrorism operation. I need a very specialized form of AI. And you can do that. And you can do that without this often mentioned billions and billions of dollars invested each and every year by Google and AWS and so on. But again, coming back to how we really, really leapfrog is having this hardware agnostic software. We try to install with our industry something which is called software-defined defense. So you have to imagine in former times, if you bought a tank or a plane or a warship, there was IT in it, but only by chance. It was needed to run this platform. It was not about the IT bringing a special capability to the table. It was about the platform, and this platform needed some kind of IT. And German automotive industry, as well as I think world's automotive industry, started in the early 2000s to separate platforms and software because they needed new business cases. Yeah, so the next 10 horsepowers didn't really sell the next new car, but new ways of connectivity did sell new cars. And for us, it's the same. It's about how to have platforms with a life cycle of 10, 20, 30 years plus sometimes still being up to date, and software's the way to go. And that's really a chance where we can leapfrog a lot of things happening on the market, because we already have around 5 years of work with industry. We are right now at a point where we are starting to implement architecture for this, open modular architectures like the US already has in law, for example, MOSA. We see other European countries coming to us, the UK, France, and so on, and wanted to talk about this approach and how we can do it together. And that's a way to leapfrog, because you don't have to redo each and every step of an innovation. You have this app layer, and there's suddenly a huge market for brilliant minds bringing solutions to this app market.
Excellent. I don't need to answer that. He said it. I was going to say in the UK, and then he said what I was going to say.
But this is a good example. I mean, this is one of the questions. Cybersecurity doesn't work in silos. Cybersecurity has to work broad. And is this an example of working together then?
It's in everything. That's that whole people always wanting to, I made this point earlier, IRL in life, in real life. You know, it's not a matter of it being online or in the real world. It's actually all life. It's just different components of your life. And that's how it is with cyber. It's just a different component of your life, but it needs to be in every aspect, because it is part of everything you do. It's in part of everything that you're using, your refrigerator, your car, your phone, the microphone.
I think cybersecurity is a bit like firefighting in a village. You have to do it in everything you do. If you leave out any aspect of the life of your community, it will start to burn. So I can have the best firefighting force in this village. I can have the best alarm systems. If one of the persons doesn't think about putting out the candles at the evening, it will start to burn. And that's what it really is about. Cybersecurity starts with each and every one of us. And like you said, in each and every aspect of our life, that's what makes it so complicated. And that's, by the way, what makes hybrid attacks and hybrid threats so attractive, because you can aim at each and every one of us and each and every aspect of our daily life, not only our working life, our private life, our social life, our love life, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, this was actually one of the things I was coming to, because you said cyber security, hybrid warfare. I think the weakest part, I mean, in all of this is me, because I need to be aware. I need to make sure that I'm take care of my computer, that I take care of, you know, viruses, etc., that I'm open-minded when I'm running around and see people, I don't know, putting some logs close to a train track and set it on fire, maybe I would call the police immediately and don't think, oh, this is a friends, whatever, gathering. So how do we mix this up? Because most of, you know, the society gets the news, obviously. I'm not talking about the misinformation, but with all of this action, isn't there, we also have to strive to balance between to be safe and again, or is data protection a yesterday word and privacy and all of that?
I have to say, first of all, that the weakest link in everything is always a person.
Yes.
It's the weakest link, but also the strongest link. And that is the complexity of being a human. That is the complexity that exists when you're doing anything in cyber, in warfare, anything that we do in the world. It comes down to the complexity of being a person, of being a human. So while we can build the world's strongest network, it may just be that somebody spills their coffee and hits a switch, or that somebody happened to just close their eyes and flick a switch accidentally. And that is how simple it is. You're swatting a fly and you hit a switch. It can be that simple, but at the same time, it can also be something fairly complex. And that is the duality that exists in being a human, but also in dealing with machines.
To get the impression we should do this as a team more often, because that was exactly what I wanted to say. Yeah, you're the weakest link, but also you're the strongest. Whenever you start thinking about things, whenever you start doing even the tiny little bit, you're going from this zero to a one and two and three, and it's up to you to do it. Will you reach the 10? No, you won't. That's being realistic about everything in life, but it's totally up to each and every one of us to be more mature about cybersecurity, about how to counter hybrid threats aimed at us. That's totally in our hands. We're not dependent on someone else to do that. Of course, we need an overall organization by government, by state. We need police forces. We need dedicated cybersecurity forces, all that. But it starts with us, and that's a very good message. We can start.
That's true. But I mean, when I think about the general approach of education here in Germany, when it comes to internet was the first, like, you know, how to deal with all of that. I think we might have to change our approach there also for the kids, for parents, for all of us. But I agree that there's hope for sure. In our conversation before, and it comes to my mind, like the question is, two questions. One is, who scares you most and from whom could we learn the most?
I'd say those who scare us the most are also the ones we can learn the most from.
That's very diplomatic.
Probably not very political correct, but it's true. Because we always have to ask ourselves, why are we scared by some actors? And we'll also start to discuss about the term being scared. I think, again, it comes back to being aware about different potentials and threats different players can bring to the table, to the game. But if I know there's some players with a very high potential of hurting us, hurting our company, hurting us, our society, the next question is, why do they have this potential? And how can they play out their game? And that's also the first step to countering their potential and take it away from them. So don't get me wrong. It's not about copying what they are doing. For example, fake news is something we would never do. But it's about understanding and taking away their means to do it.
I was just thinking about this. I read this article over the weekend and we had a short chat about this. It was in the FAS. There was an interview with Anton Hofreiter, prominent politician from the Greens. And he gave some thoughts about our efforts in terms of defense. And he mentioned that we in Germany should be very aware buying cars from China with all of the you know, technology in there, and that we cannot be coming back to the topics of privacy and data protection, that we for sure cannot be sure that, you know, when they have cameras back and front and in probably inside, what do we do with that? And is this just hypothetical, or is this something we as people should be much more aware of what we are buying here?
As we know, I have three A's, and it's awareness, advocacy, and action. And it is really about making sure you are aware of what you're using, what you're buying, what you sell. But when it comes down to the cars, I believe it was, I actually had to have a look, and it was around 2007 or 8 that Audi was tasked with some cars that they were manufacturing for some companies in China, and also the companies wanted them to put in tracking software. And Audi said no, which is why Audi had a little bit of a freeze in China. They weren't doing any business in China for a while, but that happened. So it's not a new phenomenon. It's always existed. It's existed because people, bad actors, China, whoever, learned from us. They then, you know, reverse engineer what we're doing sometimes if we haven't developed it, and then they sell it back to us. And it's a concept, it's constantly done. Everything, everybody's looking at Chinese phones or computers or tablets. When I lived in China, that was when the iPad came out. The very next day, it was less than 24 hours, there was a Chinese model exactly like the iPad, just without the Apple logo. And that's because we are manufacturing in China. So, as you said, there are bad actors everywhere, but it's what we can learn from the way that they do the things that they do, and what we can do to subvert. I shouldn't use that term.
That's Why not?
Such an espionage term, and I'm not a spy. That the things that we can do in order to make it a lot less comfortable for when they want to do something nefarious.
You asked if data privacy, laws are dead. I don't think so. I think they are getting more and more important. But and that's the big but. If we want to keep up the level of our technology and of our competitiveness, and on an international level, we have to do it, at least in Germany, we have to do it, from my point of view, personal view, a bit differently. We've got one European data protection law and 16 versions in Germany for each and every country. And we had a discussion even going down to the communal level. So we would have been talking about some thousand extra interpretations of one law. And that's a lot of problems arising from that, because, I mean, how do you want to have a common market if you're segmented like this? How do you want to have a sovereign technology which is able to compete with China, with the US, if you don't have a common European market? So yes, no, it's not dead. We need it. And I think it's a selling point. It can be a USP, a unique selling point for us, but we have to do it right. And we're not allowed to do what we did during the Middle Ages. We have 20, 30 something little kings and whatever in Germany, and each and every one has to give their own laws. No. If we have a European law, it should be a European law. But again, disclaimer, my personal point of view, but I think if we want to have digital sovereignty in Europe, we need to give up a bit of our federalism at this part.
But then you also have to make sure that that's built in-house.
Most definitely. And I would like to I would love to see that, because it would bring jobs and money to Europe. But yeah, you're right. I mean, but the question was for data privacy, and I wouldn't skip it. It's also about ethics, and it's about how we see humans and how we see the interaction of technology and humans, especially if we're talking about AI. And the last thing I would skip was ethics and our view on the human as as the overarching value in the world. So if we agree on that, data protection is needed. Again, the question is only how we do it. And if we do it wrong, the enemy will use it against us. That's crystal clear, because there will be very cheap products brought to the market. They will tell us that is possible with our products, and people will buy it. Because, be honest, if I can get a Chinese car for half the price of a German car, of course a lot of people will buy it. And they will buy it, perhaps knowingly, that their data is no longer safe. But it comes down to price.
And I will, of course, every time you're optimistic, I'm going to be pessimistic, because we have to make sure it's even. But even if we do it right, bad actors will always find a way to take advantage of that. For every yin, there is a yang. It doesn't matter what we do. We can do something 100% perfectly, or what we deem as perfect, and before you know it, it's already been pulled apart. Whenever you build a system, there's always going to be somebody trying to subvert that system. Whenever you do something that's completely ethical, there's always somebody looking for a way to do something nefarious with that, take advantage of that, and because there's always somebody looking for a deal.
Agreed, and that brings us back to our common conviction, we will never reach the 10.
Exactly. There's always somebody wanting to get something cheaper, faster, and unfortunately, people are willing to pay.
Yeah, but this comes then to the information that we as people get, right? And maybe this, we had this discussion earlier about the proximity of threat. Like, if the proximity of threat is that my car is going to be used to spy on my neighbors, maybe this would be not the reason, but maybe if I realize that whatever I have in my kitchen is sending the data right back, and I know about this, maybe this would be one of the reasons. But I also wanted to ask you, when you think about all of this technology that's out there, is there anything which is really, like, if you look at startups, the innovation that you see, is there anything where you say, this is really ringing a bell, this is making me really hopeful or excited in this field, in your expertise?
I would say the sheer number of people bringing their minds to certain problems. And what I said early on, for me, serenity is about having a choice. And if I have a large number of brilliant minds trying to figure out different solutions to a problem, there will be choices. And that's what I'm looking forward to, so that we no longer only have to look to the big industry, but also to smaller, more agile entities, which can bring different, totally different solutions to the table.
I always think of the fact that in what's deemed as developing nations, there are people building tech for survival. You can use the Ukraine model, just not a developing nation, but because they had war, they built drones for survival. And you look at places in Latin America, you look at places, some countries in Africa, even some places in China or in the Far East, people are building for survival. They're not building because it's a luxury item, a convenience to have something, a drone deliver food for you. They're building for survival. They're building for medical products to get from A to B because the terrain is bad. That's where I think that innovation really is coming to a forefront. And I'm excited about that, because there are people with very limited means that are building just whatever for survival. So there is an urgency to what they're building. There's also an urgency and intensity and a different mindset. And I do believe that mindset in Europe, in the UK, and in the US have weighed down the possibilities of people doing a lot more innovative work, because it's always driven by profit.
Yeah. Well,
You're going to agree. I know you're going to agree.
It's hard, but I have to agree. Yeah. That's what we're seeing too. That there is a lot of effort now coming from places where we wouldn't have thought about some years ago, which is producing solutions and products which are absolutely essential also for us. For me, now again speaking a professional role, the question is how can we get this mindset over to us? So how can we move away from this always looking at the dangers first and perhaps again be more a bit what advantage can be achieved by doing something? What is the possible positive outcome of something? I mean, one last point, the French are very protective about the language, but there are some German words which made it into the French language, and one of them is Le Gesamtkonzept. So it's the overall plan translated. That's not really nice to use exactly this word, because what's behind that? It's what, especially in Germany, really has been our driving factors for the last decades. Mm. Always thinking everything down to the last and most tiniest screw and think about each and every possibility the system could face and the solution could have and this and on. And after 10 years, we see, our product is ready. It's probably the most perfect and most secure product, but it's 10 years late and somebody else has already sold a million of the same product, what, 10 years ago. So, And how can we have this innovation spirit coming over to us, and how can we foster that from a governmental side by reducing laws, perhaps by bringing money to the table? That's something what we are really sorry. That's the advertisement part in my speech. That's what we are trying to do now by setting up our Center for Innovation of the German Armed Forces here in Erding, quite close to Munich, because we really want to have this spirit come to us, work with us, and us being there to help them make their first steps.
Mm. I think, I'm going to say, I think. Oh, no.
Oh, now you're damned.
I should say, in my opinion, as I said, mindset, but that has to start at the young age.
Yeah, so we come back to the question of education and how
it has to start at a young age, and it has to be, I would say, indoctrinated.
Yeah.
Into children at a young age with that mindset, so that when they are learning, they're learning and adopting the way that they are developing with technology in a different manner. But coming back, silos. The unfortunate evil in how governments, private sector, and the military have worked in the past, which is why the government has to take forever to pass a law, whatever, hence, GDPR and everything, how long it took. And by the time it actually happened, it's like, that's been circumvented. But then you look at the technology is moving at such a rapid pace that people in government are basically getting elected and they're out of office before the technology has gone leaps and bounds, and they're only, 2 weeks into their terms. Mm. It's just the conundrum, because you have people that are in government that have no clue about the technology. So they look to the big actors and big players to explain the technology to them that is then being sold to the government. They're buying the technology, and you have that evil circle. And then you have people that are trying to do something innovative in government, in the military, but your hands are tied because of government. Mm-hmm. And it's so frustrating to see. I'm sure it's frustrating to live, but I don't live in that world anymore. Yeah. So
Daniel is already standing in the green light, which gives us just a very short last round. One of the things I take with me is I think there's a lot of willingness. And if we're very optimistic and realistic, the colleague from Lithuania mentioned earlier that 2022 was kind of this force for unity. for the NATO, I think it was in that case, and that could it be that, and pretty short, and just what needs to do, like, could it be that the proximity of threat, which is getting closer and closer, especially on cyber and hybrid war, could it be that this is kind of the unity moment for whoever wants to be part of Europe and the EU anymore, to kind of get together, to get rid of silos, so that there's actually straight talk?
Most definitely. I mean, if not now, when?
And you see that too. Like, this is.
Yeah, I do these. That's what I meant when I said the sense of urgency is now there. Is it already enough? No, of course not. Again, coming back to your scale of 0 to 10, I'd say we're somewhere around the 3 or 4 level. But it's there and it's growing. It's ever growing. And that's really, really important for us to keep that, to keep that momentum and to keep that development, because that's what makes us strong as an alliance, as European countries, that we have unity. And that we are not divided between one of us is in danger and the other ones are only standing by and looking what's happening. So, yeah.
As long as the divide and conquer does not come in. And I think that's the biggest issue, is that egos come into play, misinformation, disinformation, and that possibility.
True.
That bad actors are able to really influence that division. And as long as those seeds are not sown and that they're not, you know, grown, I think there's definitely the chance. I think this is what we are most definitely at a pivot point right now.
Okay. Well, I think maybe next year we can see in which area, in which, you know, direction we pivoted to. But I take a lot of optimism and realism with me, being the weakest and the strongest part here, everybody. So thank you so much, Suki. Thank you so much, Dr. Pitch.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.